You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. I'm Sarah Custer, and joining me today is our data editor, Simon Baker, to talk about some of the stories he's been working on recently. Hi, Simon.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Thanks for coming in.
That's all right, no problem.
As data editor covering higher education, you've got plenty of data sets to delve into pretty consistently.
Yeah, there's plenty of higher education is definitely one area of journalism which has plenty of data to have a look at. So it's rich pickings, really.
Yeah, from government data sets to different research institutes that are constantly giving out different studies and figures from that. But one that you are consistently looking at is the Elsevier Scopus database, is that right?
Yeah, that's right, because we have access to the sort of Scopus database, and that is basically a tool. Well, Scopus is something which is all the research that's indexed, journal peer-reviewed research that's indexed, and you can look at various individual pieces of research, but also Elsevier has a kind of a tool which allows you to look at all the data that comes out of Scopus. It's called SciVal, and that allows you to look at kind of bibliometric data. So you look at how much research is being published, its quality, various other indicators, and you can do that for countries, universities, groups of universities or groups of countries, all sorts of different ways of looking at that data. So it's kind of a really rich resource for trying to look at some of the information behind the stories on which countries are doing well in research, which countries are lagging, how they're doing, say, for working with industry. There's so many different things that you can use SciVal for to kind of try and get an angle on some of the stories that we write about all the time.
Yeah. Well, in your recent SciVal rummagings, you came up with a story recently that was quite interesting, looking at how the top performing universities cooperate with universities in less developed nations.
Yeah, that's right. So something which kind of occurred to me a couple of months back was it would be quite interesting to see how much the sort of top ranked universities collaborate with some of the poorest countries in the world. And there's actually a kind of really good United Nations kind of grouping that it was a good place to start. They call them sort of least developed countries, and it's obviously based on indicators like GDP per capita and various other things.
Mm-hmm. Can you just give us an idea of what countries are in that group?
So, they're mainly countries in Africa, which unsurprisingly it's around about 40 countries, but they'll contain all the sort of the least developed African nations. So, you know, not somewhere like South Africa, and various other kind of North African countries. But it does have places like sort of Tanzania or Sudan, or it's basically the sort of the countries that by GDP per capita has the UN places them as sort of the least developed. I think it's probably about half the countries in Africa, really. And then it does have some other countries from around the world, like Laos, Cambodia, for instance, in Southeast Asia. And then lots of kind of other sort of smaller, a few other smaller countries that are down as being some of the poorest in the world. So it's a good grouping, and you can use that with SciVal to kind of, you put a request and say, like, I want to take this group of countries and then I'll look at all the research they publish. And then from that, you can look at who they collaborate with. And what was interesting about looking at this is those kind of countries published a sort of total of around 60,000 pieces of research where they collaborated with people outside their own country between 2013 and 2017. And then from that, you could look at how much of that sort of 60,000 pieces of research were actually involved collaborating with one of the top 10 universities. And that was pretty fascinating, really, because only sort of two of the world's top 10, Harvard and Oxford, sort of published more than 1,000 of those, or were involved in publishing more than 1,000 of those papers. And Oh, if you look at the amount of research that each of those top 10 universities publishes it with an international collaborator, you could then sort of look at the percentage of that that they published with one of these countries.
Looking at it kind of from the other side.
Yeah, from the other side, exactly. Yeah. So if you can imagine that, so you flip it around and then you can see that Oxford basically had the greatest share of its overall cross-border research that was published with a poor country, which was sort of 3.2% of its international collaboration. Mm-hmm. Harvard was 2.9%. Imperial was also above 2%. 2.2%. Every other top 10 university was below 2%.
Mm.
So, and that's kind of, you imagine the amount of research they publish with academics in other countries. It's still quite a low total if you think about it. If you're trying to think of ways to improve those countries and both in research terms, but also just kind of doing the sort of innovation that they will need to kind of catch up with the rest of the world.
Hmm. Yeah, and also kind of contributing to the common good that universities say they're constantly striving to do. And and also I could imagine looking to the future, which countries are going to be the most important globally in the next 50 years. It's certainly not going to be countries in Europe or in North America.
No, exactly. And I mean, if you compare it with, say, the amount of their international research that they do with China, for instance, it's way higher. And, you know, for obvious reasons, China's sort of developing. But yeah, the universities are always talking about, okay, what they're doing is for the sort of common global good, but and how important international collaboration is. But it does show that what they're, most of their research when it comes to international collaboration is with each other. A hell of a lot of it will be with each other. And then also with kind of rapidly developing countries like China.
Mm.
But really, if you want to kind of pull those the poorest countries up to the level and help them develop, then, you know, there needs to be some research that's done with them as well.
Yeah.
Another sort of important aspect to this, which I sort of found, was that some of those findings were kind of skewed a little bit by how much a university does medicine, for instance, because obviously a lot of collaborative research with the poorest countries of the world is going to be in the medical area, because
right.
it's about kind of tackling disease in those countries and that kind of thing. But also, the more I dug into this, that you sort of realise that all the kind of international funding there is for that kind of research is all in a medical sphere. So it comes from big charitable funds like Wellcome Trust or Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, or it might come from Medical Research Council in the UK, or EU funding, or National Institute of Health in the US. So that's where the majority of the money is. But so many people that I spoke to about this, and it's a fascinating kind of article to put together, said to me, well, it's not just medical research that these countries need, it's engineering, they need to sort of improve their infrastructure.
Sure.
It's information technology, it's computing, there's so many other things that if you want to develop those countries that you need, it's not just kind of medical research, really.
Yeah, and one also has to wonder if the medical research that is taking place there, how much that's actually helping the people in those communities, or if it's medical research to kind of go and test things that then universities will take back and implement in their own
communities. Well, yeah, that's a really kind of interesting political argument, that comes along, is how much of this money is just really being used to kind of help the reputations of these universities, because they go in there, they do this research, oh look, we're working in this poor country, we help, and how much is it really actually helping?
You also regularly use the data from the World University Rankings to source stories and find some real nuanced trends that are coming out of that, and we recently released the 2019 World University Rankings. So what are some of the stories that you've pulled out of that so far?
Yep. So what's good about every year that we release the sort of rankings data in a way that's consistent with the last few years, which is we've done for a few years now, there's not really been a change in methodology. It means you really get a sense of kind of how things are changing over time. What I like to do with the rankings data is to kind of look at how sort of countries are before you look at the averages for different countries across the sort of 13 metrics that we have. in the rankings, and then you get, although we're only talking about ranked universities, so the sort of elite in each country, you really get a sense of how each country's top universities are performing in various different ways. So what was kind of one of the more fascinating aspects of the data this time around was looking at how universities, those top universities in each country, are sort of performing on internationalisation.
Mm-hmm. Big agenda setter from
Absolutely.
Those institutions.
Yep, and obviously something that's really impacted by a lot of the political trends at the moment with Brexit and Trump in the US. And although our data sort of is not as up to date, maybe as the kind of doesn't go back to sort of right now and what's happening with Brexit, what's really interesting is you can see that the UK on internationalisation had already sort of stalled. Really, although the UK is one of the top performing countries in the world for how many international students it has, how many international staff, and it's the amount of research it does with universities abroad. It hasn't really changed across the last few editions of the ranking.
Interesting.
At the same time, other countries have been kind of improving. Australia actually overtook the UK and is now higher for its average score.
So this is in our international outlook pillar, or what are we measuring here?
So this is the international outlook pillar, which basically is an overall score for internationalisation, where those three metrics I mentioned before, staff, students and co-authorship of research.
Mm-hmm. Staff, student mobility, co-authorship research, yep.
Yeah, mm-hmm. they all feed into that pillar.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the average kind of pillar scores for this year, Australia is now ahead of the UK. Two other interesting countries which are, virtually caught the UK now, the Netherlands and Canada.
Wow.
So, and if you dig into the kind of individual metric scores that underlie that, you see, if you look at the sort of international students, for instance, the UK, again, it's stalled. It's actually fallen back on its average score a little bit. In this latest edition, Australia is now kind of on a par or just ahead of the UK and the Netherlands and Canada. If you look at their scores on that metric, they've just been going up sort of rapidly, really.
Interesting.
So, I mean, it basically sort of illustrates that even if you take politics out of the equation and Brexit, then it really reflects what's happened in the Netherlands and their kind of real drive to have lots of degrees in English, and in Canada, where they've got a real sort of open door policy on post-study work,
mm-hmm.
And immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And that is I think that really is reflected in this data, whereas in the UK, in the period that we're kind of looking at here, there was a sort of definite kind of clamp down on, especially on post-study work as a kind of way to, as a magnet for students to come here, and to kind of not make it so easy for graduates to stay here after coming from another country.
Right.
And so this is even before Brexit. So
right.
Who knows what's going to happen, you know, in the next few years when it comes to the UK.
Where does China sit in this analysis? Because that's another big contender that people are keeping their eyes on.
Yeah, so China, when it comes to internationalisation, is kind of much sort of further down.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of sort of average scores, it's more like, it's just below the US, actually, because the US doesn't do so well on internationalisation.
Why is that?
Well, essentially, it's just because they're big countries. The big countries are lots of universities that attract so many international students as a share of their student cohorts, really, or academic staff. I mean, the US has lots of very high quality homegrown academics, whereas a small country like the UK, or even more so, say, kind of hubs like Singapore or Hong Kong,
mm-hmm.
they're obviously
or the Netherlands, as you mentioned.
Yeah, the Netherlands,
yeah.
They're going to have a lot more people, a lot more mobility going on,
mm-hmm.
really. For the article, I also pulled in some interesting data from the OECD, which sort of showed which countries were, over the last few years, starting to send more students abroad and which ones were starting to have more coming in.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting about China there is it's a country that's kind of doing both, really. It's increasing the numbers of students that are coming in and increasing the numbers that are studying abroad, mm-hmm. which is kind of quite an interesting indicator looking to the future, because it suggests that it's out of a lot of countries that are developing, it's one that is going to be a powerhouse in the future, which is going to have its universities that attract people to come in, as well as it's the one country that you think is going to really compete with the US and Europe in terms of student mobility.
Yeah, definitely. And it looks like the balance is shifting finally from them sending out hundreds of thousands of students a year to actually attracting more and more, which is something we're already seeing.
Their strategy really is to, okay, their students that do go abroad, the idea is that they will get their PhD and they'll come back with that expertise from European and US universities, and then they'll use that to grow the Chinese system, which will then become more attractive, not just for domestic Chinese students who then won't need to go abroad so much, but will start attracting people from Asia, especially that region, but also the whole of the world. And it's as well, just like research on international mobility, you can see China just being a powerhouse in the next 20 years.
Yeah, and we just published a story this week showing that the volume of research papers that China's producing has surpassed the United States.
That's right. And on quality, I did an article a few months ago showing that you could forecast that China might even overtake the US on quality towards the end of the 2020s, really.
You mentioned OECD just a minute ago, Simon, but their Education at a Glance, which is this massive...
Yeah, Education at a Glance, except it's,
whatever
it's the funniest title for any kind of data set I know of, because it really wouldn't take you... It would take you weeks to actually go for it.
Very loose definition of glance there. So just... For the last few minutes that we've got here, for our listeners who probably haven't had a chance to pore over the data like you have, what were some of the headline figures that stood out for you that you decided to explore a little bit more in your work?
So, yeah, I've pulled out four kind of startling facts from Education at a Glance that led me to sort of write articles about it. You can find more on the website if you search our website for... data stories, then you'll find some more expanded explanations of these. But so basically, some of the top things were that I looked at the fact that sort of England and Japan, for instance, have the highest proportions of graduates who say they're in a job that only needs a school leaving qualification, so they're overqualified. So
England and Japan,
yeah, that 30% of graduates will say they're overqualified in their job. And that led to another article that explored kind of the skill level of graduates that say they're overqualified with those that say that they're well matched to their job. And that revealed that actually places like England, there's a big gap between the sort of numeracy scores of those who say they're overqualified and those that are well matched. And the OECD Director of Education, Andrea Schleicher, sort of said that this was perhaps evidence that... that some degrees in England just aren't of a high enough quality. So that kind of led to that was covered in quite a lot of the press. So that was an interesting fact there. Another one I sort of found was that if you look at postgraduate degrees and what people go on to earn that have a master's or a PhD, in the US, someone with a PhD or master's will earn more than twice that of someone who just left school with school leaving qualifications.
Okay.
But in Sweden, it's only 35% more.
Okay.
So it's quite a big difference in the world between if you've got a postgraduate degree, how much you go on to earn compared with somebody who's just left school. There's lots of very interesting reasons for that. You certainly shouldn't jump to the conclusion that it means a postgraduate degree is more valuable in the US than in Sweden. It has a lot to do with income inequality in the US generally, and Sweden much more equitable sort of country when it comes to income.
Right.
So someone who's just doing a job with a school leaving qualification will have maybe a higher level of standard living anyway. And then there's other reasons to do with the kind of market there is for master's and PhD degrees, and the types of subjects they do, and the demand from employers for those degrees. It's interesting that Australia, New Zealand were two other countries that have low postgraduate premiums for earnings, if you like.
Hmm.
And some of the people I spoke to for that article suggested that's maybe something to do with the fact that in Australia there are a lot more, it's more of a mass market for masters, and there'll be a lot more kind of masters sort of in humanities sort of degree, subjects which don't necessarily then lead on to specific jobs, whereas in the UK you might have more masters that are kind of vocational.
So
there's lots of reasons behind what's going on.
So it could be that in Australia there's just kind of flooding the market, so it's not really differentiating workers that much as it would in other countries.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the possible explanations. Yeah. I would say it definitely was. But
okay.
But also someone also said that Australia and New Zealand, they have higher sort of minimum wage. So that means that the kind of gap between a school leaver and someone with a postgraduate degree is less. So that's very interesting. I'll give you another bite from this. Was that according to the latest Education at a Glance, between 2010 and 2015, the spending per student in countries across the OECD increased by 5% for schools, but 11% for HE. And when you dig into that
might
further,
be quite surprising for people who are listening to this podcast.
Yeah, and you know, obviously we write about higher education, but some people would say, well, school education is potentially more important, really.
Yeah.
Why is that happening? A large part is driven by the US, the UK, Australia, countries that have basically fees systems of one kind or another.
So this is just all sort of investment. It's public and private investments. That includes tuition fees, governments, all that stuff. Okay.
It's everything. Then, but that average is being driven to a large extent by those countries that have a lot of private investment in HE.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can argue that certainly in the US that there is a kind of sort of arms race when it comes to tuition fees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does that huge amount of money that's being spent per student in higher education reflect the actual quality of what, you know, the value that's added for those students going to university? Are they really getting a much better education than someone in Germany, for instance, where actually spending per student has been going down recently? Because although they've kept overall spending at a level, they've just seen student numbers increase quite a lot. So it's been... The spending per student has been coming down, mm-hmm. but is a degree worth less from a German university than the US? You know, it's quite, these are all very
fascinating. It's very complex. Yeah. More OECD figures that you've got are available on our website in all of the news stories that you've published recently. That's timeshighereducation.com. Simon, thanks very much for coming in.
Yeah, no problem. I hope it was interesting enough. I know it's a lot of numbers, but it's there's some fascinating topics out there when you start digging around.
Great. Well, we'll definitely have you back in to discuss some more stories that you're doing in the future. Like I said, you can find all of Simon's pieces on our website, timeshighereducation.com. Thanks for joining us. And if you've got any comments for the podcast, you can always let me know via email, sarah.custer@timeshighereducation.com. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.